Good to see each of you today, and I would like to start off this morning by just testing all of your memories. Are you guys game for that? You good for that? You awake? All right, here's what I'd like for you to do. I'd like for all of you, as best as you can, to try to think back to when you were kids. All right, now I know for some of us that is a really, really long time ago. For others of us, it's not quite as far back, but I want for you to try to think back to when you were kids. And specifically, I'd like for you to try to think back to when you were a child and you remember being told that it was 3 weeks until Christmas. Okay? To which now some of you are a little nervous because I'm hinting at how far out we are from Christmas, right? And if, as you think back to when you were a child and you think back to when someone told you you were about 3 weeks out from Christmas, I want for you to try to reflect on and try to remember what were the thoughts that were rattling around in your brain. What were the emotions that were stirring around in your heart? What were you thinking about back when you were a child and it was 3 weeks out from Christmas? You know, as I think back to when I was a child and I remember hearing that it was about 3 weeks till Christmas, I was one of five boys. I had four brothers. And I remember back to when I was told this, that for me, there's certain words that I think would describe the emotions that I felt. I was stoked. I was pumped. I was excited. Christmas could not get here fast enough. And when I think about the reasons why, or why I was so excited about Christmas, and why I couldn't wait till Christmas to get here, is for a number of reasons. One is I wanted to stay home from school. Can I get a witness on that from anyone? Yeah, I wanted to stay home from school. I wanted to sleep in. I wanted to play with all my brothers. I wanted to just hang out and have a good time. I wanted to just open the gifts. I couldn't wait to open the gifts. And then I also just couldn't wait for my grandparents to either come in town to stay with us when they would come in from Florida, or for us to go to Florida and hang out with them. Because with a household of five boys and a pretty large family, guys, Christmas was a big deal for us. It was really, really a big thing. But you know, as I think back to those days and I think back to those emotions, what I also can think back to and what stands out to me is that the emotions that my parents tended to have in them, what I could observe, were very different from the emotions that I had and the rest of my brothers had. Because see, for me, Christmas couldn't get here fast enough. But for my parents, when they found out that it was 3 weeks until Christmas, it was that moment where you looked at panic on their face because of two reasons. One, they had not even started their Christmas shopping. And I know some of you this morning, you haven't started. And that's okay. Don't make your list now. Wait until after the service. But two, let me give you the second reason why my mom and dad were stressed. Was because this year, they had to figure out another hiding spot for all the presents they were going to buy. Because all the ones before that, myself and my brothers, we'd already found all those. Now, let me just ask, because we're all friends and we're going to be honest at church, how many of you actually went out looking for your gifts when you were a kid? Any of you? Uh-huh. How many of you found them? How many of you actually unwrapped them and played with them and then wrapped them back up? Yeah, and acted surprised at Christmas. Yeah, y'all are deceitful. Y'all are worse than I am. I didn't do that. You know, but when you think back, isn't it true? When you think back to Christmas, when you were a child, you honestly could not wait. It couldn't get here fast enough. You had all these emotions, all this excitement, all these things building up in you. And you know, today, fast forward many, many years later, now I'm the father of five. And I have four of which that can understand that right after Thanksgiving, as we start telling our kids we are only weeks out from Christmas, I can see that they too experience the same emotions that we experience as kids. For my kids, one of them actually told me the other day that he can't wait until Christmas because he hates school. Okay? Now, he does well in school, but he said he hates school. And so he wants to sleep in. He wants to hang out with his brothers and his sister. He can't wait to go to Honey and Dandad's house at Christmas and open gifts over there. That's my wife's mother and father-in-law. He can't wait to go to Nana and Pop's house, which is my parents, and open Christmas. I mean, they can't wait for that stuff. They get excited about dressing up in their Star Wars outfits, which they've been doing that lately, and fighting with lightsabers. I mean, they're just looking forward to all this stuff. And here's something I've discovered, though, is I've been thinking about just kind of what takes place in the hearts of kids and really what takes place, especially this time of the year, is that, and I've started using this. This is for free. This is just a little parenting trick for you, is I've recognized that this time of the year, a child who's in a healthy environment in a home where they feel loved and they feel taken care of, this time of the year, a child, at a minimum, has in their life a pretty decent level of hope in their hearts, don't they? Just this time of the year, the seasonality of it, there's this level of excitement. But what I've recognized, too, is that this level of hope is they're anticipating, they're looking forward to something that they desire to take place, which is Christmas, which means get out of school, stay home, go to grandparents' house, the presents, the whole thing. And I've started using this to my advantage as a dad, because the other problem you battle is as they get closer, it's a little more difficult to get your kids out of bed. Isn't that true? Because they're just already thinking about Christmas. So each morning, what I've started doing is I've started walking in my kids' rooms, and as nicely as I can, I turn on their light, which they don't like that, and I'll say, "Kids, we're 3 weeks away from Christmas." And I'll say, "We're 3 weeks away from going to Honey and Dandas. We're 3 weeks away from going to Nana and Pops. We're 3 weeks away from you staying home, sleeping in, opening presents and all that." And what I do is when I'm doing this is I'm reaching into my bag of Christmas cheer and I'm putting hope in my kids' lives. And I'm just building their hope up. And so with each day, I keep going to them and I keep saying these things. And what happens is as their assurance or their confidence in what they desire to take place continues to increase, continues to grow in their life, their hope follows with it, right? And so by the time we get to Christmas and I just go in day after day and I'm doing this and I'm putting hope in their lives and I keep telling them, "Hey, we're another day closer, we're another week closer, we're a few more days closer." What happens is my kids, as their hope continues to increase in their lives, the thing that naturally follows with hope is excitement and joy and this thrill. Isn't that true? Isn't that how it works? So that by the time we get to Christmas morning, my kids' eyes are this big around. Your kids are. They had this giddy little laugh. And they are so, so pumped and excited because their hope is overflowing with joy. You know, when you think about your life and I think about my life, the same is very, very true, isn't it? Is that very simply in our lives, when we walk around, we all have a differing level of hope inside of us. But as we walk around in life and as we have just certain things that we desire in life, like a career, maybe in our health and our relationships and all these things that we have desires for, that as our confidence continues to grow and continues to become more secure, our hope tends to follow it. But also when our confidence is shaken in those things, our hope tends to drop as well. Isn't that how it works in your life? I know that's how it works in my life. I know that's how it works in many of the lives that I come in contact with as well. You know, this morning, what I want to do is I want to just help us flesh out a little bit more what this looks like in the lives of people by looking at how when confidence in God specifically is secure and growing, that our hope in God follows it. But when our confidence in God starts to wane and our hope tends to follow that, what that looks like. And to do that this morning, I want to take you back in time to right at 4,000 years ago, just very briefly, and I want to share with you about a group of people that experienced what it was like to have their hope with their confidence very, very high in their lives, but also what it looked like for their confidence to be shaken and for their hope to basically wane and to the point where it would dissipate to where there was much of nothing left. To do this, let me introduce you quickly to an individual. Many of you have heard of him. He's found in the Old Testament. His name was Abram, but his name was later changed to Abraham. And in Genesis chapter 12, verses 2 and 3, we see that God, Yahweh, had an encounter with Abraham. And Abraham at this point was not a believer in Yahweh. He was just kind of out there living his life, doing his thing, carrying around a little hope in his life. And in Genesis chapter 12, verse 2 and 3, I want you to see what took place in this encounter God had with Abraham. So we put the verse up here on the screen. God says this to Abraham, "I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, that you will be a blessing." Now, keep following with me, verse 3. He says, "I will bless those who bless you, Abraham, and him who dishonors you, I will curse. And in you, all the families," not some, not a few, "all the families of the earth shall be blessed." So God has this encounter with Abraham, and he makes a promise to him. He said, "Abraham, I'm going to choose you, and from you, I'm going to make a great nation. I'm going to give you descendants that number like the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore," as he said in one encounter, one discussion with him. "And I'm going to use you to bless everyone." And after Abraham heard this, no doubt, as he was sitting there pondering, Abraham probably raised his hand and said, "God, can I ask you a question?" And God said, "Sure, go ahead." Abraham probably said, "God, there's one problem. The problem is that I'm really, really old. Really, really old, in my 90s to 100. And so is my wife. And I have zero kids. There's no way." And God told Abraham, he said, "Just trust me. Just trust me. Because I'm going to do something, and I'll show you that I can be trusted. Years pass by. Eventually, Abraham and Sarah get pregnant with their son Isaac. And when they got pregnant with Isaac, immediately, the life of Abraham and his level of hope was maxed out. Because his confidence in God and what God said he would do, God did do, his confidence in God just overflowed in the hope and the excitement that was in his life as well. For years, guys, every time Abraham would talk about that encounter with God, every time Abraham would talk to Isaac and even to his grandkids and his Isaac and his grandkids, and for generations upon generations upon generations, as they would communicate and talk about this encounter that Abraham had with God, is they would always speak with great excitement and thrill because they had so much hope, because their confidence in God and what God said he would do, he did do, was so high that it just continued on for hundreds and hundreds of years till one day in Egypt. There was a Pharaoh that came into leadership, came into power, and he had forgotten about a boy by the name of Joseph that many years before had basically rescued the world in a famine. And when this Pharaoh looked out at all these descendants of Abraham that were living there in Egypt at the time, and he looked out at them and he saw them and how great they were growing in number, just as God said would happen, he was scared of them. And he said, I know what we'll do. We'll make them slaves. And he made them slaves, and he put them in horrible, horrible conditions. And at this point, we know in biblical history that these descendants of Abraham, their hope started to dissipate. And for very good reason, because their confidence in God was shaken. Because God had made this promise. He was making them a great nation, and now they're slaves, personally and together as a group of people. And they started crying out to God, and God did nothing. They cried out to God again, and God did nothing. They cried out to God, and their hope with every passing day just continued to go away and go away and go away, to where in many cases their lives looked a lot like that by comparison to this. And with each passing day, their hope went away. Finally, one day, a guy by the name of Moses shows up, and he says, hey, God sent me to come and get you out of this. And they were like, yeah, wow, where's your army, right? And then after a series of events, Moses took the children of Israel, the descendants of Abraham, led them out of Egypt through the Red Sea to the brink of the Promised Land. And then Joshua, 40 some odd years later, took the baton from Moses and his leadership, took his generations behind that preceding generation and behind them, and took them across the Jordan into the Promised Land. And what happened? Their hope was overflowing because their confidence in God continued to increase and their hope followed with it. For years, we find in history, what happens is that they get a king, they get Saul. And when Saul was leading the nation of Israel, they felt like they had an identity, like all the nations around them. Then David comes in to be king. And I'm telling you guys, if you want to see it a hopeful, excited, pumped nation, it was during that time. Because David was the greatest king ever. And it was during David's reign that God told David, he said, David, one of your descendants will reign on your throne forever. And when God told David this, again, David's life was overflowing with hope. He passes the baton on to his son, Solomon. Solomon rules. A lot of things go well in that time, especially for Solomon. But after Solomon moves off the scene, quickly in the history of Israel, and this group of people who had great hope, everything began to unravel. The nation split in two. Part of the nation was taken into exile at first. Then the other part was taken into exile. They were conquered. The nation lay in ruins. And every one of these people were crying out to God. And for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, guys, not for like one or two, for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, it seemed like God turned his back on these people, that he had abandoned them, he had forgotten them. And then we find ourselves at the time of the New Testament, to where the gospel accounts were written, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And we find ourselves in that period of time to where these people, the majority of these people, this is what their life looked like in their confidence in God as well as their hope. There was hardly any left. Many, if not most of the people, had given up hope in God because it seemed like God had abandoned them. You know, something you know as well as I do is that in life, it takes hope to get through, doesn't it? In every area of life, it takes hope. You need to have hope that you can get better when you're sick. You need to have hope that your marriage can get better when you're having struggles. You need to have hope that this stinking economy will get better, right? I mean, you need hope. But I'll tell you what's worse than all is when you lose hope in God. When you think God has given up on you, turned his back on you, and abandoned you. And that's where when you open the pages of the Bible and you get to the New Testament, most people in Jewish life, that's where they were. You know, the story of Abraham is very true about you and myself in many ways as well, right? For those of us in the room that are Christ followers, that have a relationship with God through Jesus, somewhere along in our journey as we're living our lives and we have a hope for the American dream, a hope for a future, a hope for family, a hope for health, a hope for all this stuff. Somewhere along the way, we have this encounter with God personally to where God, in some way or another, gets your heart and he calls you into a personal relationship with him through his son Jesus. And in that moment, you gave your life to God. You believed in Jesus. And when this took place in your life, back in the time when this took place for you, like for me, it was 16 years ago. You think back to how that your life, no matter where your hope was at the time, your confidence in God just exponentially grew and your hope grew as well, right? And your life looked like that. You were excited. You were pumped. You believed God could do anything. You believed that God would do anything, that God loved you. That's what you believed. And so as a result of that, your lifestyle changed. You quit doing certain things. You began doing other things. You started giving sacrificially. You started serving sacrificially. That there were certain things in your lifestyle you didn't feel like God was happy with, so you quit doing that. And out of faith and out of this great overwhelming hope, you live for God. But isn't it true that many of us can also say that in this journey, however many years that's been for you, months that's been for you, is that you have seen times where it all started unraveling in certain areas? That just like the children of Israel, Abraham's descendants, you've seen things in your life that have pushed you to the brink of losing hope? Because isn't it true that every practical area of your life that you live is intertwined with God when you're a follower of God? Whereas before it was just kind of a bad day or bad luck or coincidence or whatever, but now all of a sudden when things don't go the way that you hope they would and the way you desire, then all of a sudden God gets brought into this and then your confidence in God is shaken and everything starts to come and unravel. Isn't that how that works? And you find yourself in these moments looking up to God and saying, God, do you care? God, are you there? God, will you do anything about this? Will you heal my marriage? Will you heal me in my health? Will you help me in this career? All these things that we're going through, it is so deep and personal to us, isn't it? But with our confidence, as it fluctuates, our hope does as well in God. And at some point, and I don't know if you've ever had this happen in your life yet. I think we all will face these times. We all do face these times. But at some point in your life, we will all, as Christ followers, those that have a relationship with Jesus, we'll always come to a point to where everything seems to unravel. Our hope is waning. There's hardly anything to hope in. And you're going to feel like God has abandoned you. And it's in that moment you have a call. You have a decision you have to make. Are you going to throw in the towel and give up and move on and go back to the things that you were doing and things you used to do because it seems like if God's abandoned you, why won't I just abandon God? You're even going to question, is this just a myth? Is this even real? This is where you'll find yourself because you have lost hope. This morning, here's what I want to do. I want to encourage you right where you're at, some of you, because some of you right now, you're at that point. I want to encourage you for the future. And I want to hopefully help add a little insight into your past, those of us that have been through these types of moments. And I want to share with you that the story of Christmas is a story of hope. The story of Christmas is the story of hope. And this morning, I'm going to share a part of this Christmas story that honestly you may not see coming. Because when you think of the Christmas story as the story of hope, you think of it in one light, just like I do usually. But actually, I want to take you to a part of the Christmas story that oftentimes is overlooked, that many of us don't even really think about at first when we think of the Christmas story, and for good reason. But I want to take you to a time that, as I said earlier, was a time to where, as individuals, most people had given up hope in God because seemingly God had abandoned them. This was a time to where, as a nation, a lot of people thought that God had just turned his back on them. And it's into that context, into these circumstances, that Luke, a physician, recorded his gospel account in Luke chapter 1. And I want to show you how Luke starts the Christmas story. In Luke chapter 1, verse 5, he begins by introducing us to the main characters that he wants to talk to us about. And he says it this way. In the days of Herod, king of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah. This is one of the main characters. Of the division of Abijah, and he had a wife from the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. So in this story, as Luke starts out his account, what Luke is speaking to is, he says there's two characters. There's Zechariah and there's Elizabeth. They're married. And he gives us some information about them. They were basically preacher's kids. Their parents, their dads were priests. And so he gives us this information to let us know, okay, that this next statement is kind of weird to actually say about preacher's kids. And many of you will know why as I read it. Watch this, verse 6. And they were both righteous before God. Now look, I am a preacher's kid. And there are very, very few preacher's kids that I've ever heard that have been stated that they're righteous before God. Okay? And those of you who have encountered preacher's kids, you know this is true, right? But they were righteous before God. They walked blamelessly in all the commandments and the statutes of the Lord. So Luke has just given us this note. He describes who they are. They're preacher's kids. They live lives that are awesome before God. And the reason why that's so, so, so important is because about what he's about to state next. Verse 7. But they had no child because Elizabeth was barren and both were advanced in years. Now, all of us in this room have either personally been through this, know someone who's been through this, or know of someone who's been through this to where you can't get pregnant and you really, really want to, right? I've already shared our story. We have babies just walking past each other, okay? So it hasn't been a problem for us. But I've had friends that could not get pregnant. And it was heart-wrenching for them, right? For those girls that want to have a baby and just can't get pregnant, and the battle of the heart, and even for their husbands, and all that goes with that. But let me just tell you that in this situation with Zechariah and Elizabeth, this is the same type of heartbreaking type situation or heart-wrenching situation, but times 20. And the reason is for this. In their culture, ladies, if you couldn't have a baby, you really couldn't fulfill the main thing that your life was of value for. Now, I didn't say that. That was a cultural thing. And it was in this context that as Elizabeth could not get pregnant, it appeared, and many people would make these judgments, that if you couldn't have a baby, it's because you're on the wrong side of God. You were cursed by God. And so it's into this that we look at Elizabeth and Zechariah, who are hopeless as a nation. Rome has rule over them. And as individuals personally, they're doing everything they know to do. They're hanging in there. They're living for God. They're trying to do it as their hope waned, both on a national level, but also on a personal level, where it seemed like that in every way, God had abandoned them. Even when they were doing the right things. This is possibly where some of you are. Or where you've been. You're hanging on by a thread. But you keep following God. And then he continues in verse 8. He says, now while he, talking about Zechariah, was serving as a priest before God, when his division was on duty, according to the custom of the priesthood, he was chosen by lot to enter the temple of the Lord and to burn incense. Now, just in our day, this is kind of weird, but in their day, this was very, very important. The priests in their day who represented the people would go before God, and they had a shift. They would rotate these things amongst the different divisions. But for a priest to have the honor to do this in his lifetime one time was a huge deal. And so Zechariah, coincidentally, was able to go in and to do this. Verse 10. And the whole multitude of the people were praying outside at the hour of the incense, like, okay, this is a big deal. And then verse 11, and then there appeared to him an angel of the Lord standing on the right side of the altar of incense. And Zechariah was troubled when he saw him, and fear fell upon him. So here Zechariah is. He walks into the temple, not into the holiest of holies, but in the holy of holies, the outer room. He goes over to his altar of incense. He's searching for a match. And then to his right, all of a sudden, there's someone standing there. Now, this is like breaking the rules, okay? And immediately, he's probably thinking, who's that? And he looks over and it's an angel. He's like, whoa. And fear struck him. He was gripped by fear. This is why when you hear people tell angel stories today, and that, like, you know, I went out with Angel Billy Bob and we had a Coke, that doesn't really work with Scripture, because when an angel appears, you're usually afraid, okay? And so this is what happened to Zechariah. And after Zechariah's kind of freaked out, then this angel says something to him. Verse 13. But the angel said to him, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah." To which Zechariah's thinking, easy for you to say, right? And he says, here's why. For your prayer has been heard. For your prayer has been heard. Isn't it true that when you feel like that your confidence in God is shaken, and you're doing everything you know to do, and you're praying, and you're crying out to God, and you're serving, you're sacrificing, you're giving, you're doing all those things that you know to do, that all you really want to hear sometimes is that God says, "I hear you." But isn't that the challenge sometimes? Isn't that the problem sometimes? Is that we don't feel like God does, as if our prayers are hitting the ceiling. In this moment, when Zechariah was freaked out, the angel said, "Don't be afraid. God hears your prayer. He hears your prayer about wanting a child. He hears your prayer about the nation. He hears your prayer for hope." And then the angel continues. He says, "For your prayer has been heard, and your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you shall call his name John," like John the Baptist. Verse 14, "And you will have joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth, for he will be great before the Lord." He said, Zechariah, here's the coolest thing. Your kid is going to be awesome. He's going to be awesome. You will rejoice. Everyone will rejoice because he is going to be great before God. He continues, "And you shall call his name John, and you will have a joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth, for he will be great before the Lord, and he must not drink wine or strong drink." To which some of you here are thinking, I'm glad I wasn't John, okay? He was a Nazarite vow that he had to take. "He will not do these things. And he will be filled with the Holy Spirit, even from his mother's womb." That from his birth on, this boy, this kid, your kid, is going to be used by God in a mighty way. Verse 16, "And he will turn many of the children of Israel to the Lord their God." He's saying, Zechariah, hope again. Why? Because God hears your prayer. Zechariah, your son, is going to bring hope back to many, many people who have lost hope by turning them back to the Lord. To which Zechariah, as all this is filling his heart, as all this is filling his life, he has to have questions, of course, which we'll get to one of his questions in a minute. And he says he'll turn them to the Lord their God, and he will go before him in the spirit and the power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready for the Lord a people prepared. In essence, John is going to pave the way for the Messiah. Your kid is going to make the way for the Messiah. And so after all this is settled and everything was registering and firing around in the cortex of Zechariah's brain, Zechariah raised his hand and he said, "I have a question. How shall I know this?" Or in other words, how will I know this is even true? That you're not like pulling my leg. "For I am an old man and my wife is advanced in years." Now he's a smart guy. Notice he said he was old, his wife wasn't old. She's advanced in years. So guys, make a note. Make a note. Advanced in years. Okay? That's a good phrase. You know, we say, Zechariah said it's in the Bible. Verse 19. "And the angel answered him." And at this point, you know, the angel's probably like grabbing his chin, looking down and shaking his head. He says, "I'm Gabriel. Remember like a little while ago when you were freaked out by me? Now you're asking me if this is even possible?" It just doesn't make sense. He says, "I stand in the presence of God, and I was sent to speak to you and to bring you this good news." Verse 20. "And behold, you will be silent and unable to speak until the day that these things have taken place. And here's why. Because you did not believe my words, which will be fulfilled in their time. In the middle of this life that Zechariah and Elizabeth were living, with hope circumstantially and confidence in God being shaken by the entire nation, by the entire group of people, over being under the rule of Rome, in oppression, taxed near to death, poverty was everywhere, all that. And then personally, not being able to have a child to where everyone seemed to judge them as if, yeah, your priest, your preacher's kids, but your wife must not be doing something right because she can't have a baby. In the middle of that, when the angel Gabriel showed up and had that encounter with them, he said, keep doing what you're doing. Hang in there. Keep obeying. God hears your prayers. When it appears that God is silent and God couldn't care what you're going through, he does. And the other truth that he heard and what he learned in this time was when the angel said, these things will be fulfilled in their proper time. Some of your translations may say appointed time. And what the angel was telling Zechariah in this situation is that when it looks like God has gone dark, when it looks like that God is not active and God's not working for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, and here they are waiting and hoping for a Messiah, someone to rescue them, to restore the nation, when it appears that all that has just dissipated, what Zechariah learned that day is that God has a timeline and he's working it and you can bank on it. It just may look very, very different from your timeline. Keep his hope in God. In verse 21, and the people were waiting for Zechariah and they started wondering his delay in the temple. Like, okay, is this not going well? What's wrong? And when he came out, he was unable to speak to them, and they realized that he had seen a vision in the temple, and he kept making signs to them and remained mute. Now, as I thought about this, I don't know what Zechariah did, but he probably came out, he can't talk, he's doing all this, he's flapping his arms like, you know, an angel, however that looks. He was doing all that stuff, and these people figured out, okay, something really, really big has happened. And then this is kind of interesting, verse 23. And when his time of service was ended, what did he do? He went to the house. He was like the first guy at the clocking out, right? Now, why did he do this? Remember what the angel told him? Verse 24. After these days, his wife Elizabeth conceived. So this guy was like, all right, I got to get home. It's business time, right? He goes home. Now, ladies, I don't know what lines your husbands have used with you, but can you imagine him coming home? He can't talk. He's drawing like, you know, he's doing angel's wings. He's doing baby stuff. And he's, you know, and she's going, oh, good grief. Don't you have something better than that? But she conceived. Well into her years, she conceived. And for 5 months, she kept herself hidden, saying this, thus the Lord has done for me in the days when he looked on me to take away my reproach among the people. See, today, as we sit here and as we've been through things, some of us are going through things. Some of us, or all of us likely, will go through things. Is that when we find that our confidence in God is shaken and our hope evaporates with it, we get to look back on a story like this to where these people could identify both as a nation, where I know many of us here today are struggling with our nation, just what's going on, has God turned and walked away from the United States of America? And we can identify with them on a personal level because some of us are struggling in our marriages, we're struggling in our health, and maybe with a prodigal kid or our financials or wherever. And we can look at them and we can say, okay, I can learn from Zechariah and Elizabeth that it's in those moments, even when my hope is like this, that I need to hang in there. I need to keep doing what God's called me to do. I don't need to throw in the towel. I don't need to give up. And here's why. Just as Zechariah learned, God hears your prayers. He hears your prayers. God's working, just on a different timeline than many times that we would hope that he would. And one of the greatest things that I think we should take away from this act, part one act of the Christmas story, is that can you imagine with me that if Zechariah and Elizabeth had thrown the towel in and had given up, what they would have missed out on? They would have missed out on a miracle. They would have missed out on the miracle that they had always desired and hoped for and prayed for that God would do. They would have missed out on that. The nation of Israel could have missed out on John the Baptist that went out into their day and their culture and prepared the way of the Messiah, Jesus. They would have missed out. People would have missed out on the hope that John brought to them. You know, for you this morning, here's what's so incredible, and for me as well, is that as we can learn from their story about hope and where we can place our hope and what to do in the middle of the times that our hope seems to be evaporating, the story didn't stop there, did it? Luke continued in verse 26 in Act 2 of the Christmas story. In the sixth month, the angel Gabriel was sent from God to a city of Galilee named Nazareth, to a virgin betrothed to a man whose name was Joseph of the house of David, and the virgin's name was Mary. You know, we look back, and we get to look into the Christmas story, the full-fledged Christmas story. And Jesus says to you and says to me, right in the middle of whatever you're working through and when all hope seems to be lost, he looks at us and he says, keep your hope in me. I hear your prayers. I hear your cries. And I don't just say that. This is what Jesus would say. I don't just say that. I don't say that from the heavens through prophets and through writers. I don't just say it that way. I actually stepped out of heaven for you. I came for you. And guys, that message of the Christmas story, when we reflect on Jesus stepping out of the heavens as a baby, born of a virgin a little over 2,000 years ago, not just saying I love you, but showing that he loves you by coming to you and for you, the same as he has for me, in each of our lives, instead of living a life that's hopeless like this, as we embrace this time of the Christmas story and we reflect on what Christmas is about, our hearts should look like this. Because our confidence that our God hears us, our confidence that our God loves us, our confidence that our God has come to us and for us is extremely high, no matter what we're facing. And so because of that, our hope should be high. The thrill should fill our hearts, the excitement, the joy. Because Jesus has come for the world. I love each of you, even some of you I don't even know. My prayer is this morning, is that from your past you can now reconcile where your hope should have been, or maybe what you learned through that process, in your current situation, that you would know what to do in the midst of hope seemingly evaporating. But as we all move towards the future, I just really, really pray that all of us would just focus in on, soak up the Christmas story that Jesus says, I haven't abandoned you, I've come to you.